Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin on this Labor Day and assess the damage Donald Trump is doing to the lives of working Americans with his recent assault on unions and his corporatist takeover of the judiciary, as Trump recites right-wing idiocy speaking out against big tech, albeit in a dangerous and cynical defense of Alex Jones's right to spew out his conspiracies and hate speech online. We will speak with Stacey Mitchell, the co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. She joins us for an update on the real issues facing labor and the threats posed by the gig economy from companies like Google and Amazon, whose founder, Jeff Bezos, the richest man in the world with a net worth of over $155 billion, can't even conceive of paying his workers better wages or his fair share of taxes, and instead would prefer to erect a giant rocket ship to Mars as a monument to his wealth. Then we'll go to West Virginia, where the recent wave of teacher strikes have shown hopeful signs on the ground of what can be accomplished when workers come together and demand economic justice. Anne-Marie Lafazo, a professor at West Virginia University College of Law, where she teaches labor and employment law, joins us to discuss how, in her red state, where super-rich political leaders have conned the electorate into voting for a plutocratic agenda veiled in faux populism, just like in the case of our president's election, West Virginians are becoming activated as they see the fruits of victory from these massively popular wildcat strikes. Then finally, we'll speak with Sam Pizzagatti, a veteran labor journalist and an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, whose latest book is The Case for a Maximum Wage. He joins us to discuss his article at inequality.org, Would You Recognize a Plutocracy If You Saw It?, and give us an update on the state of organized labor in our country, which appears to be becoming less of a democracy and more of a plutocracy. But on a cheery note on this Labor Day, a century ago, Americans faced a plutocracy just like ours today, and they beat it back just as we can today. And joining us now is Stacey Mitchell, who is the co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance and the author of Big Box Swindle, The True Cost of Mega Retailers and the Fight for America's Independent Businesses. Her recent reports include Amazon's Stranglehold and Monopoly Power and the Decline of Small Business. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stacey Mitchell.
It's great to be with you.
And thanks for joining us on Labor Day. And it is very sad the extent to which small business is being eviscerated across the country, and that the power of these huge corporations like Facebook, Google, and Microsoft. I mean, it used to be like 10 years ago, ExxonMobil was the number one most powerful company in the world. It's completely flipped. And if you think these companies like Alphabet are powerful now, in 10 years' time, based on the trajectory they're on, they're going to be even more powerful. So we have a president who's finally taking on Google, but for the stupidest reasons, and to do with their algorithms in terms of how they aggregate the news. And at what point do you think the Washington establishment will deal with the real issue of antitrust and monopoly?
I hope that it's inevitable. I mean, I think it's very difficult to have a situation where you have companies like Amazon that increasingly are the infrastructure for commerce. I mean, they really are the gatekeeper and the interface for the buying and selling of goods. Their interest isn't so much in dominating the market as it is in being the market. So you've got these, as you noted, these big platform monopolies like Google and Amazon that are the intermediary areas of both information and commerce. And that ultimately is untenable in a democracy. It means not only rising levels of economic inequality, but it also means a loss of political control and inability to steer the direction of our own society because we're turning so much power over to these giant tech companies. And so I feel as if inevitably Congress is going to have to deal with that. And the faster that lawmakers get out ahead of this, the better. The good news is that there is this growing bottom-up movement really demanding that lawmakers look at antitrust and the ways in which the antitrust has gone wrong in recent decades.
Well, we know that Trump hates Jeff Bezos because, one, he's a real billionaire as opposed to the fake billionaire that Donald Trump is. But, two, he owns the Washington Post, which is, as Trump calls it, the fake media. But it's extraordinary that as much as Trump is on this jihad against Bezos, Bezos is getting these massive contracts with the Department of Defense, billions of dollars, to take literally all of the Department of Defense's data and move it onto a classified platform in the cloud.
You know, it's really, you know, it's a terrible thing when you have a president who gets on Twitter and sort of indiscriminately attacks various companies because he sees them as his personal enemies. And so, you know, that's unacceptable, I think. That said, I think we shouldn't get distracted. I've been dismayed at the number of people who've responded to that in the need to defend Amazon. And I would argue that Amazon is as big a threat to democracy, if not more of a threat to democracy in the long run than Donald Trump even is. Amazon has gotten to where it is, not just because of its innovations and its brought to the table, but it's also very strategically, all the way from the beginning. You know, when Jeff Bezos founded the company in 1995, one of the very early strategies that he hit upon and has used extremely effectively ever since is to get government handouts and government favors that are not available to his competitors. And we're certainly seeing that right now, whether it's the auction that he's initiated among cities who are vying to get Amazon's second headquarters. We've got offers on the table from some places as high as $8 billion in public dollars set to be handed over to Amazon if they locate in Maryland, $7 billion if they locate in New Jersey, you know, and on down the list. I mean, this is extraordinary. And Amazon, as you noted, has also been extremely adept at getting these government contracts, and not only getting government defense contracts. I mean, they're a major provider of cloud services for the CIA. They're in line to get this big Defense Department contract that's being decided this year. They've also got a grip on a growing amount of just sort of the commercial goods that the federal government purchases. And they're actually going after the purchasing of local schools and cities and counties across the country. And part of how they've been able to do that is by developing this very cozy relationship with government. And then when they get in there, they leverage that relationship to actually push other competitors out of the market. So it's both a horse at the public trough, if you will, and sort of gaining the advantage that comes with just getting public dollars. But it's also an anti-competitive strategy in terms of how Amazon then uses those government contracts to undermine competitors in that space.
And again, I'm speaking with Stacy Mitchell, the co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance and the author of Big Box Swindle, The True Cost of Mega Retailers and the Fight for America's Independent Businesses. Her recent reports include Amazon's Stranglehold and Monopoly Power and the Decline of Small Business. So Senator Sanders has taken on Amazon in a kind of war of words. But I also understand, and I may have not have this entirely correctly, because I'm trying to remember exactly where I saw it, but I believe maybe it was Human Rights Watch or some human rights organization was critical of the working conditions at Amazon. But certainly Senator Sanders has made no secret of the fact that they don't pay a living wage. And he's called upon Bezos, who's worth about $155 billion, to basically take care of your workers. And Sanders implored Bezos to, quote, pay your workers a living wage and improve working conditions at Amazon warehouses. So on this Labor Day, let's talk about the new labor market, the gig economy, the idea that people, first of all, that they can, Amazon can blackmail cities and states in a competition to get their headquarters with massive subsidies. But then it's all to do with the idea that they're offering up jobs in the community. But what kind of jobs are these?
They're incredibly demanding and punishing jobs at Amazon warehouses. You know, these are jobs where people are on their feet, running around, lifting, standing, reaching under things. And it is very much a situation where you're a cog in the machine, you know, quite literally. A lot of Amazon's warehouses are highly automated, and people have these handheld devices or things that are attached to them that count down the number of seconds that they have in order to reach for a particular item or to get something off a shelf or to do some type of action. And they're not being helped by the machines, but they are in sort of a cog. They're serving those machines in the process. So it's very automated. It's a dehumanizing in many respects work environment. And it's also very low paid. We did an analysis of Amazon wages. We looked at hundreds of data points across 11 metro areas. This was in 2016. And we found at that time the average wage in Amazon warehouses was under $12 an hour. We also found that about 40% of the workers in a typical Amazon warehouse are temps. They are temporary employees that Amazon usually hires through a staffing agency. And it does that in order to, be able to have them come and go as it pleases. But also, if they're injured on the job, their workers' comp claims don't come to Amazon. They go through the staffing agency. These are not great jobs. And I think, the other thing that I would mention in this context is that Amazon is eliminating a lot more jobs than it's creating, because a lot of communities are losing retail jobs. We're losing small businesses. A lot of the other pathways to the middle class are being really squeezed out of the market by Amazon, and what it's offering us in return are a smaller number of not very good jobs.
So when you said earlier, Stacey Mitchell, that Amazon is not just trying to join the market, they're trying to be the market. There's some concern, for example, when they bought Whole Foods, that that was the nose of the camel in terms of moving into that kind of part of the retail market. But explain your thesis, if you will.
Yeah. Even just a few years ago, when people were looking to buy something online, they would typically go to a search engine and they would type in what they were looking for, running shoes or a toaster oven or whatever it was. And they would get a variety of different results. It would include Amazon. It would include other retailers. It might include a local independent store, for example, in their community. Now, more than half of all shoppers start directly at Amazon. And that's been a shift. It's been driven a lot by the Prime program, Amazon Prime, and also increasingly by Alexa, their voice assistant. This has enabled Amazon to develop a really sticky relationship with customers. And what that means is that for any other company in the economy that wants to sell consumer goods, whether it's a retailer, small retailer, large retailer, a small manufacturer, large manufacturer, every other company that wants to reach consumers online is increasingly facing this really difficult decision. They either continue to have their own website and there's less and less traffic out there for them to attract, or they become a third-party seller on Amazon's website. And growing numbers of companies are finding that that's what they're having to do in order to continue to reach customers. When they become a seller on Amazon's website, they hand over to Amazon data about their transactions, about their products, they hand over their customer relationships, and they hand over a substantial share of their revenue. We know from a lot of research that's been done by Harvard Business School and others that Amazon uses that information about those sellers and what they're selling to compete against them. It looks at what they're selling well, brings those items into its own inventory, and then gives itself top billing in the search results on its website. It also squeezes those companies in various ways. And the point that I think is really critical here is that this is not a market. What Amazon is looking to do is to replace a market. A market is an open arena, is an open space that is, governed by public rules where everyone has an equal opportunity to compete. On Amazon's platform, we have a private arena where other companies are having to play by Amazon's rules and where there is not an equal opportunity to compete. So this is fundamentally anti-democratic, what it is that they're setting up. And that basic conflict of interest, that ability of Amazon, the dependence that other companies have on Amazon if they want to reach the market, and the fact that Amazon is also competing against them, is really a fundamental problem with this company. If you think about it from Amazon's point of view, it's an incredibly lucrative thing that they have set up here. I mean, essentially, they are the sort of modern day railroad. Other companies that want to reach the market, need to have access to that infrastructure. And that power enables Amazon to decide, well, here are certain goods and services that we want to offer. We've picked out the items we think are going to be most lucrative for us to do. And we will privilege our own products on that infrastructure, and we'll make other competitors essentially invisible to consumers. And for everything else that we don't want to deal with, everything else that's bought and sold in the economy, we'll let other companies do that, but we'll charge essentially a kind of tax on their trade through the fees that it charges those companies to access its platform. So no matter what the transaction is, Amazon is making money, either doing it itself or taking revenue off the top from other companies. It is a very exquisitely designed machine for funneling wealth to Amazon.
And so that's what you mean when you say Amazon is laying the infrastructure for the new retail economy.
That's right. And, you know, we talk about Amazon as though they're a retailer, but really what they really are is an infrastructure company. It's about controlling the platform that other people need to use in order to get to market. And, you know, I've been talking a lot about the online platform, the site where people shop, but Amazon is also making moves to control these other big chunks of infrastructure. So they control about a third of the world's cloud computing capacity. And what that means is that a lot of their competitors like Netflix, Condé Nast, the big publisher, Comcast, a lot of other companies that compete with Amazon in various ways also rely on Amazon Web Services to get to market. So we have the same dynamic going on in that way. And then Amazon is also increasingly moving into package delivery and shipping. And, you know, they're looking to supplant UPS and the post office, and they're making big inroads in that. They're using Whole Food stores as part of that strategy, also using a gig labor model and undermining what are unionized employees at UPS and the Postal Service. And again, their idea there is it's not just about delivering their own stuff, but it's about being the gatekeeper, the delivery service for other firms, and being able to essentially extract rents, if you will, from those other firms, extract wealth from those other firms. So ultimately, at the end of the day, this is so fundamentally different than Walmart, which is also, you know, a big company that has monopoly power in some sectors, and I'm, you know, deeply concerned about. But Walmart is just a retailer. Amazon is something fundamentally different. This is a new kind of monopoly, and one that I don't think people can be. We really need to be quite alarmed about.
And again, these big five companies: Amazon, Apple, Facebook, Google, and Microsoft. Microsoft, of course, just reached the $1 trillion mark in terms of its market cap. And they have spent collectively in 2017 lobbying the U.S. government the $50 million, which of course is small change considering Jeff Bezos' net worth of $155 billion. So give us a sense of what the chances are of some antitrust action, given that we have money-driven politics. Our legislators have essentially been turned into telemarketers. They spend all their time raising money and very little time doing the people's business. So, needless to say, he who has the most money in Washington buys the most politicians.
We have been here before, and I think that's, you know, a really encouraging thing to reference. You know, we have been in this situation as a country before. We were here in the 1920s, for example, when we had just enormous levels of concentration across the economy, small numbers of companies that controlled whole industries, record levels of inequality, a lot of political corruption, you know, a lot of the same kinds of things that we're seeing now. And there really was both a bottom-up movement and good political leadership that eventually addressed that in the 1930s. You know, Franklin Roosevelt came along and he looked across the country and he recognized that, you know, the farmers that were protesting, New York banks that were fleecing them, you know, farmers across the Great Plains, that the folks in small towns who were fighting AMP, which was the Walmart of its day, the big grocery chain, the folks in cities who were fighting against these electric company monopolies that used to price gouge. You know, he looked out there and saw all of this kind of local activity that people were sort of fighting back against the corporate powers that they found in their own lives and in their own communities. And Roosevelt really really recognized that the root cause of all of that was monopoly. It was corporate power. And he campaigned on that issue, and he won, and he built in his second term, he built this, really robust approach to enforcing our antitrust laws. And for decades, we enforced those laws quite well. There was a sea change in the 1980s, embraced, started under Ronald Reagan, embraced by some subsequent Democratic administrations that really undermined our antitrust and changed the way that we enforce those laws. There is now beginning to be a move back in the other direction. And it's very encouraging. We've got economists, legal scholars, lots of people now who are doing work and showing the ways in which concentration is really harming Americans and harming the economy and our democracy. And we're beginning to see voices in terms of political leaders who are speaking out on this. You know, we had the formation of an antitrust caucus in Congress last year, which was a huge development. Both the Republican and Democratic parties in the last presidential election included antitrust in their platforms. That was the first time the word antitrust showed up in either party's platform in decades. We've got folks like Elizabeth Warren who are outlining very specific kinds of policies and she's been a leader in calling for the revival of antitrust. We've got Zephyr Teachout in New York who's running for attorney general and is running on a strong antitrust platform. So is Keith Ellison who's running for attorney general in Minnesota. All of these things are very new just in the last couple of years. And so we've got, an uphill fight and got a lot of work to do as citizens to take back our country. But there are some good signs. The kindling is there and there's some people really speaking out.
And meanwhile, the richest man in the world, the owner of Amazon, Jeff Bezos, with his $155 billion valuation, of course, it tends to fluctuate, particularly when Trump attacks Amazon. His ambition is to colonize Mars, is it not? I mean, he doesn't seem to be, as a human being, he doesn't seem to be interested in the earthbound problems of improving life on this planet, but rather having this fantasy of colonizing space.
That's right. Jeff Bezos told a German media outlet recently that he didn't quite know what to do with his $150 billion in personal wealth, except to spend it on going to space. I think a lot of people found that quite shocking and a real measure of perhaps how out of touch he is even with his own workforce. I also, I think one of the things that he's up to these days that I find especially both noteworthy and astonishing is that he's creating a palace in Washington, D.C., right in the heart of the people's capital. Bezos bought the largest house. I don't even know if you could call it a house, a mansion. He bought the largest mansion in Washington, D.C., and has been engaged in recent months in a massive renovation project. You can actually see the drawings for this online. And, it's a palace. It's a space with huge ballrooms, with a big circular driveway, with areas for servants and caterers and so on. I mean, this is a place where he is going to host the nation's elites, for various kinds of social functions. And, I think our founding fathers and mothers would be, rolling over in their graves if they could see this. And we should be outraged ourselves.
Well, Stacey Mitchell, I thank you so much for joining us on this Labor Day.
It's great to be with you. Thanks.
And again, I've been speaking with Stacey Mitchell, who is the co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance and the author of Big Box Swindle, The True Cost of Mega Retailers and the Fight for America's Independent Businesses. Her recent reports include Amazon's Stranglehold and Monopoly Power and the Decline of Small Business. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into hopeful signs for labor from the popular teachers' strikes.